This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about scores, education and the law. I am joined by barrister Alice de Coverley from Three Paper Buildings Chambers in London. Within the high-profile education team of her chambers, Alice is a leading light in the area of school and education law, and her extensive knowledge in this area assists with difficult and complex cases. Alice trains various instructing organisations in education laws, such as local authorities, government bodies and parents directly. Over the years, Alice has been working closely with Ofsted, providing specialist advisory and advocacy services in all areas that Ofsted regulates and inspects. Thank you so much for joining us, Alice.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. And I was just saying to you, wasn't I, before we decided to press record on all our gadgets, that we have been asked by several listeners to cover a schools and education podcast. So here we go. This is part one. And we hope that we can give you lots of interesting takeaway information here to do with our legal system that will hopefully be interesting. So let's just start by saying, what do we mean by education, schools and education and the law? Tell us a bit about that, please, Alice.
So this is a really interesting question because education law is such a broad church. If you think about education, we're always learning. So it means learning from the day you're born until
102.
If you're at university and you're 102, you're still covered by education law, so you're still protected.
Love it.
So it's about the time that you're effectively, it's about the time that you're in school and the time that you're you or your child are in higher education or further education, college, that sort of thing. So it covers quite a huge amount of time for most people, and quite formative years too. But the other thing that makes it really broad is if you think about the number of different types of schools that we've got in this country, we have academies, private schools, free schools, grammar schools, special schools, and so on. You can imagine how extensive the legal landscape is simply because of the number of different types of schools. And then on top of that, you then have hundreds of different types of universities, all with different personalities as well. So it's a really broad church.
Yes.
In my view. I thought there's an illustration, I suppose, with this. So if you have a child who is excluded from school, so expelled from school, the way in which the lawyer might help you will depend on what type of school it is. So if the kid is from a mainstream school, so like a comprehensive school, then there's detailed statutory guidance from the Department for Education to help them through that process and to protect them pretty much from start to finish. If it's a private school, then there's guidance. That guidance doesn't apply, and the matter is largely dealt with through contract law, so private law. So
wow.
There's a lot of different types of law that can apply depending on what type of school your child actually attends.
Yeah, and that's very interesting. I would have never thought that. I would have thought that a school, you know, under 16 years old is a school. Doesn't matter which type of school it is, there's going to be laws that govern them all. But that's very interesting. I mean, we've always said, I always say one size never fits all. And in this area of law, we're saying that different types of schools and educational structures, of which you named, reel them off beautifully, because I was just thinking, yeah, there's government and there's private, but you just went da-da-da-da-da, which is great. And I have to say, since all the academies and this and that started coming in, I mean, I kind of lost my way with where everything is. But one size doesn't fit all. So that is very interesting, because depending on the type of school and education centre that your child goes to or that you go to will depend on which and how the laws will be applied to it. Okay, so let's talk about the most common issues that people have in education that relates to the laws, relating to schools, parents and teachers? What are the most common ones that you see as a practicing barrister in this area of law?
So it's interesting what you say about there's no one size fits all, but there is one particular piece of law that does apply to education as a whole, and that's the Equality Act. So we do see Equality Act claims across the board. So that means protecting children or young people or people who are receiving an education service from discrimination. So we see those types of claims quite a bit, and we see them more and more because people are becoming more aware of their rights in that respect,
which is a great thing, which is very important.
And so that's one of the main things I think that we see, but really the bulk of the work that you'll find education lawyers and barristers do, at least certainly in my chambers, is about the appeals that relate to the content of education healthcare plans. So these used to be called statements of special educational needs.
Let's just pause there. Let's rewind. Statement of education healthcare plans.
No, so they used to be called statements of special educational needs.
Right.
So statements. And then there was a piece of law that changed it in 2014 to educational healthcare plans.
But when you say educational healthcare plans, I think of healthcare as in my physical healthcare. And then I think, well, how is that relating to the teaching side, being the education side? So can you just really break that down for me?
So there's three parts. There's education, health and care, EHC. So effectively, education is, well, as you can imagine, sort of how the curriculum would be delivered for you in the school. What is educating and training you in the school environment? So that could be a number of different things, but it's effectively how you're looked after in a school. And this is, these sorts of plans, by the way, are for children with special educational needs, which go beyond that which can be normally provided for in a school. So you'll have lots of children with special needs, dyslexia and so on, where they don't need these types of plans. Your child has to be at a particular level in order to get this type of plan, but more and more parents are getting these kinds of plans. But so in answer to your question, care then really means social care. So social care support.
Right.
So if your kid has difficulties with dressing, is afraid of going outside, is having difficulty socializing in the community, that sort of thing, that's what that means. That's not really school or educational, or that could they can it could be, but that's really what that might be getting at. And sometimes, of course, social care involvement might be involved if parents are also struggling because their child is very difficult to look after. That's really normal when you have children with quite complex special educational needs or behavioural difficulties. And then health, if you imagine a child with cerebral palsy, for example, they might need physiotherapy. That health side of it, or they might need psychiatry or something like that. So it's about a really holistic look.
It's about all the pieces being added to the puzzle as required, as you know, and that's what we're saying. We're saying there's a lot of that going on in terms of, you know, the system assisting children, whether it's you've very nicely explained, you know, whether it's something to do with the health that's required in the daily routine, or something to do with the social element of the daily routine, or the educational needs of the day. And what about parents and teachers? Are we saying that it's sort of, that's really what they're working on quite largely? That's the most common area of work for them in that sense?
I think that the most common things that we see with parents does relate to special needs, but it might also relate to simply our child is not being educated properly.
That's a big one. That's a big headline, you know, Ellis, because I've heard that as a parent myself. I've not necessarily felt that. I feel fortunate that I've not felt that, but I've heard that a lot when teachers say, you know, when children and parents say, oh, that teacher's rubbish. Or, you know, because of that teacher, my child didn't do well. What I can say from my own personal experience is that there's some fantastic teachers, particularly the maths teacher in my eldest son's school. And he has excelled massively because of that, because his teacher is so on point. And I'm so grateful to that teacher. Whenever I see him in parents evening, I'm like, yes, hello. So I get that. And that's a big thing for parents, where they feel that, you know, the teacher has a lot to do with the quality of learning that's going on with their child.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, our kids spend so much time, or they used to before lockdown, so much time in school. And obviously parents really care about the outcomes that their children will have from that setting. So, and also that's usually compounded if a parent is paying a lot of money for that school. So you can see a lot of claims with or against, or I might help defend a school against a claim from a parent. Where it's a fee-paying school, and because they're paying so much money, you can see why parents would be like, well, we're paying for this amazing, excellent education, and my child is getting all C's. What is this? What's going on? Why have you failed my child? So that can be quite common. But also, cases might involve schools that fail to protect the child from bullying. That might be
that's another big one, isn't it, Alice? Yeah. I mean, again, I've got one or two friends who are very, unfortunately, their children have experienced bullying, and it comes in different forms, doesn't it, in schools? Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard it over the years where parents say the school's just not dealing with it. They're not dealing with it properly. I mean, what does a parent do? What's the first thing they should do, and where can they go with that? You know, what would you say?
I suppose the first thing that's difficult with bullying is that it has changed so much. I mean, I left school about 10 years ago. And
mine's a lot more than that, actually.
But there's so much more technology and sort of so many more social media channels now. I didn't have Instagram, I didn't have Twitter, I didn't have TikTok, I didn't have Snapchat, I didn't have any of these things. And I think that's really changed the landscape for young people, which makes tackling bullying really difficult. So I suppose what schools should be doing is having comprehensive training and guidance on how to deal with cyberbullying. That seems to me to be really, really important.
Is that a big area that you see in legal practice, where cyberbullying is going on and there's parents saying, look, this needs to stop? Do you ever get teachers and schools coming to you and say, look, we've got this going on, the parents of the child or children that are participating in this sort of activity are not taking it seriously enough, they're not doing enough, it's still continuing, what can we do? Do you get those types of cases?
Yeah, so we would often get asked to advise on discipline, a disciplinary action to be taken generally, particularly in the context where, say, parents might have a counterclaim for contract, their fees under contract, and you're saying, but your child it should be excluded because they keep bullying all these other children. So we might be asked to advise on how to deal with that carefully, so to manage that process. And it might be through sort of a proper and legal and fair exclusion process. So if that child has actually done something that's harming another child, then the school would probably be in their have in their power the ability to exclude that child. But sometimes it can really be a massive breakdown in trust and love between the parent and the school. That happens quite a lot, actually. So many cases come down to a breakdown in relationship.
And they just lose respect for each other as well. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think there's nothing more disheartening, as a parent I say this, than if there is an issue and, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's in school or anywhere, but let's just take school, you know, in this context. And you turn up and you're really upset and the school hears you out and then does nothing. Mm-hmm. And that really starts that process of feeling, you know, the school's not good enough, they're not taking the right steps. So if you're a parent and you've got a child that's being bullied, the school's not doing enough. And let's just face it, I mean, you know, this isn't a podcast about bullying, but I just want to say that bullying comes in so many different forms. It can come with the people in the class excluding a child, making them feel isolated. You know, that's a form of bullying in a way, because you're excluding them, you're making them feel lonely and unwanted and not part of the group or the thing. And the school's not doing anything about it. What's next? Do parents go straight to Ofsted, for example?
No. So really importantly, the Ofsted's not able to investigate individual complaints. It certainly is not going to investigate parents' claims about individual cases in the school. It might be evidence that they might use in a future inspection, but the Ofsted's not going to come in and start investigating that. So you wouldn't escalate it to Ofsted. You would probably go through the internal processes first at the school. So that would be, well, we've had a meeting with the class teacher. that hasn't worked. Okay, so we need to have a meeting with the
year head.
Head of year. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, have we got any action points as a result of that meeting? When are we going to have a review meeting? Should they schedule a review meeting within a month so that you can see, have those things actually been done?
Yes.
If that's going nowhere, then of course you would want to arrange a meeting with the head teacher, and you'd want to make sure that all along you've got things in writing. I would probably say you didn't need to lawyer up right at the start unless the child is sort of in serious risk of harm. But I mean, if there is a safeguarding risk here and the child is at risk of harm in that way, local authorities then do generally have to be notified. And there is guidance called Keeping Children Safe in Education, which is statutory guidance from the Department of Education, which schools should be following. So that's a really important framework. That's a really important framework for schools.
Yes.
So parents read that and read the sort of sections on bullying and protecting children. Or if, for example, the bullying has a sort of sexual harassment flavour, that's unfortunately becoming more common. That's actually a work I do quite a lot of as well. There is specific Department for Education guidance on dealing with sexual harassment in schools too, which is
sexual harassment children to children. I mean, yeah. Good God, yeah. You know,
yeah,
it's there, isn't it? It's life. It's what's going on. Yeah. You know, I have to say, many moons ago when I was at school, none of this stuff happened. You know, bullying was, I'm going to fight you. That was the bullying thing. But now, like you say, and you mentioned earlier, all these online platforms that exist, and it's really worrying because child doesn't even need to be next to another child to feel bullied or to feel excluded or to feel, you know, harmed by that child. You know, and I would say to parents and teachers and schools as well, if you don't have the correct procedures in place, particularly teachers and schools, then seek advice. You know, get the advice, get the legal assistance, get the assistance from the educational bodies to help you deal with them, because it feels like life and issues are moving far more quickly than the remedies are, mm-hmm. You know, because what we're not saying, oh, rush off to, like you said earlier, lawyer up. I love that term. It's been used a lot in articles that I read, and it makes me smile. But don't just think, oh, let's go straight to court. Let's get legal advice and issue proceedings and get contentious, or, you know, because as a school, you may need to take action against a child, as we were saying, if the parents are not doing what they should be doing and that child is being left, or children are being left to create the damage, how do you then protect yourself as a school? So, yeah, I think just take advice early and quickly to take the right steps and to protect the children and the school and the teachers.
Absolutely. Because, again, the other thing that schools are getting more of are negligence claims. So if you fail to protect that child from bullying, then a school can be sued for breaching their duty of care towards that child, or a local authority can be sued for failing to protect that child as well. So schools are really mindful, and I sympathize massively for them, because there are so many different
forms
that parents can use.
But do you know what else, Alice?
It does make it difficult.
You might, we spoke earlier, you mentioned earlier, you know, if you're not happy, go to the head, the teacher of the class, you know, then go to the head of year, and then it's the head teacher. But say you're the teacher of the class, and then you don't have that structure within that school to be able to execute and deal, or you're the head of year, and you just don't have the tools from the school given to you to say, this is how we're going to deal with this, to shut it down, to nip it in the bud, to stop it, to stop what's going on. And say if you're one of those, you know, one of those teachers, and your head of the school head isn't doing enough, and the school doesn't have enough procedures. I mean, then you can go or suggest yourself as a teacher within the food chain to go and get the help and advice, right?
Yes, I think that's right. And so teachers can themselves be advocates for children. They are, and they can also arm themselves with guidance to be able to do it. I mean, you're absolutely right there. You really hit a point. There was very limited money for SEN, so special educational needs. There's less money in schools. So that does mean, you know, cuts mean crisis, and it does mean that parents can become understandably frustrated in circumstances where a school just doesn't have the resources all the time, because it has hundreds of children with EHC plans, hundreds of children who are children in need, or children who So that means children that are in the care system. And so that means that there can be a real breakdown in sort of trust when you ask, as you say, you ask for things to be done, they aren't done, but it's because that teacher or that safeguarding lead has sort of, you know, 30, 40 cases that week of, I don't know, self-harming 14-year-olds, and they have to try
Goodness
and manage
gracious.
It. And that's really tough, where you have cuts to mental health support, you have cuts to SEND support, and so on. So I think that puts real pressure on everybody to try and help children. But I think that probably makes it all sound very bleak, because it is bleak, but importantly, the spotlight has increased on mental health in the media, or on special needs in the media, on bullying, on children's rights generally, you know, the rights, the voice of the child. I think those are things that people are much more aware of, which is fantastic. So awareness of those rights, I think, means that parents are aware, teachers are much more aware, head teachers in universities, so on as well. And so that then means you have more marches to defend children who have disabilities. You might have seen special needs marches. I know many of my parent clients attend these. I know that even teachers go on these. So these are sort of cuts.
A combined cuts effort from both sides, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah. But also you see more cases being taken against local authorities and against government bodies by way of what's called judicial review, which I know you have had other podcasts on, to raise the profile of cases involving these sorts of issues.
Yes, and by judicial review, you mean review of the law. So a request is put in for a review of the law in place to try and make changes to make it more in line with whatever it is you're saying it doesn't work for, breaking that down in the most simplest
basic way. So you would be reviewing a decision of a public authority in their application of that of law or statutory guidance or so on, in a way that's shines a light on unfairness or discriminatory impact that decision may have had. There's lots of cases that are done in that way, which is really interesting. That's why I find it such a fascinating area of law, because it does.
It's so varied. I mean, I have to say, when we said, right, we're going to do schools and education and the law, I have to say, I didn't think it'd be so varied, but it's a seriously varied area of law with so many different aspects to it. I mean, I do want to go into more about what do people do once they've gone through the school system, or schools that have gone through the system of trying to repair an issue directly with the parents and the children. It's unrepairable, and then it gets litigious. Part two podcast, hopefully, that we record, I think needs to go that way. But we've got a few more minutes just to quickly mention, I mean, what does the future hold for education law? Where is it going in the right direction, where the changes are slowly but surely creeping in? Or is the fact that legal aid cuts years ago is just slicing and dicing it to the ground? I mean, what are your views on that, Alice?
So I can't not do this podcast without mentioning COVID-19. That is going to is having a huge impact on education. Everyone is obviously, I think schools broke up at the end of last week mostly, didn't they?
So yes.
We're going to see a real frenzy over the summer holidays of schools trying to get themselves ready for children coming back to school. We're also going to see results day mid-August for GCSEs and A-levels. So I'm involved in a digital review of Ofqual and the way in which they're dealing with that process and whether that's fair for young people. We're going to see from COVID the mental health impact that's had on young people from being away from their friends.
I have to say that's a big, big, big issue. I mean, we're going to be airing this podcast in, I think, September time. But I have to say, even 3-4 months at home that children have had to, especially the first sort of 3 months where you couldn't go anywhere really much, I think it's had a massive impact on the well-being of children, you know, in some way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are more children who are being educated at home, of course, in fact, all children. But a lot of parents want to keep their children at home. And so home education is probably another really interesting area for education law. So education otherwise than at school, I think is a really interesting, has a really interesting future in this country.
Goodness gracious. I don't know how most parents will feel about that, because I have to say, you know, it's the younger the child, the more difficult it can be. But then the older the child, you think, well, what do you do with them? But teaching from home, I'm not sure. My son, certainly my eldest child, said, oh, at first he was loving it. Yeah, it's great. I can only wear my shirt and tie because they were online doing school and had tracksuit bottoms and flip-flops on his feet, you know. And then it was like, oh, well, I can't really engage. He was like, Mum, how do you do art online? You know, it just doesn't work. And music online, how do I do that? I'm sitting in my bedroom on a computer. So, well, Alice, it's gone past really, really quickly. And I have to say, it's been really, really informative. So thank you so much for your time.
A pleasure. It was really interesting. I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's all good. And I have to say, we haven't even scratched the surface of this. No. And I'm just popping with ideas of what we can go into in a part two, let alone what we haven't even covered in part one, which we can also bring in our part two. So thank you so much for joining me today. And what I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you very much for listening.